Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Governor Mike DeWine is set to unveil legislation for his 17-point gun safety plan today. The original plan called for tougher background checks, a version of the red flag procedure, and expanded mental health services. If the GOP-controlled Ohio General Assembly approves any of the measure, gun control advocates would call them victories after two decades of expanding gun rights. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Jesse Balmer, state government reporter for the Cincinnati Enquirer. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Marty Schladen, a reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. Welcome.
Hi, Ann.
And Joe Ingles of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Welcome.
Happy to be here.
All right. So the governor is set to unveil his gun control plan. Is it going to still be 17 points? What do you think, Joe Ingles?
Well, I think that it's going to be as close to 17 points as Governor DeWine thinks he can get it. The problem is that the lawmakers have been sending messages that they're only willing to go so far on these things. So I think he's writing a very tough line there. He wants to have a plan that will do something that he wants done. But at the same time, we could see that the details have ways out, different ways of dealing with things that might appease lawmakers to get them on board.
What's your prediction, Jesse Balmer?
Well, I think the two most controversial things in the 17-point plan, and as you'll recall, some of these things in the plan were already done through the budget. Mm-hmm. So there
like
will be
the mental
less
health
than,
expansion of mental health services, that kind of a thing.
Yeah. And like wraparound services. Yeah. So like counseling for students and so forth. So there will be less than 17 no matter what. But the two most controversial things are this red flag law, which is essentially allowing police or loved ones to go to a court and ask that a person who is dangerous to themselves or others be temporarily removed from their guns after a certain number of hearings or what have you. That was much up for debate. And then universal background checks, so background checks on private sales of guns as opposed to just those through federally licensed firearm dealers. I think on the first, you might see a push to keep people away from their guns more than guns away from the people.
So maybe
an expansion of our current pink slip system for putting those who might have a mental health crises into treatment. And I think on the latter, you could see more penalties for those who provide a gun to someone who wasn't supposed to, as opposed to more expansion of guns. So we'll see what the details are Monday afternoon. But I think you could see, they're trying to thread a very tight needle between those who really want to see something meaningful done and Ohio's legislature, which has been very uninterested in doing much by way of gun control in recent years.
Marty Schladen, how can 85 or 89 or whatever it is percent of Ohio voters before, some of these expanded background checks, before support restrictions, work on control in the state and the Ohio General Assembly kind of be written off as a no way, no way?
Well, I think that, the very strong pro-gun community is a very motivated part of the base. These are people who turn out and vote in primaries and, those are the sorts of people that politicians listen to because they have to. A statistic that seems relevant here is I think something like 3% of gun owners in the United States own like half the guns. This is a very serious issue to them, and I think that particularly on the Republican side, they're listening to those people.
Is this, the do something chant that greeted the governor when he had his press conference and met with the public a couple days after the Dayton shootings? Joe Ingles, where are those people going with all of this?
Well, actually, they've been involved in all of this. The Moms Demand Action, you see them in the State House almost every day right now, running around, trying to talk to lawmakers, trying to sway them into their line of thinking. They've been supporting of a lot of these things that Governor DeWine has talked about, and they've kept up the pressure. And actually, when Governor DeWine unveils his plan, he's going to have Dayton Mayor Nan Whaley at his side. So that sends a message right there that he's doing something that won a Democratic mayor's support in Dayton.
That's interesting. Nam Wiliot aside, I mean, what is her obligation to all of this if it doesn't go far enough?
I think for today, she's there to show support for moving this ball forward and putting forth legislation that could make a difference in Ohio. There's going to be a point where Democrats are going to have to decide, you know, do we vote against something that isn't everything we want, or are we going to say, hey, this is better than nothing? And that's going to be a question for those who are pushing for gun reform, too. Is it enough to fix some loopholes in the background check system? Is it enough to increase penalties on people who provide guns to minors? Or is anything short of closing the gun show loophole going to be a failure here? There's a lot of different ways to define success, and no single measure is going to stop suicide, death by suicide, which is, you know, increasing, growing number in both the state and in the nation. And nothing's going to solve school shootings completely. But, you know, what can we cobble together here as a state to make it a safer place to live and work?
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. So going forward with Marty Schladen, what about Republican House Speaker Larry Householder? Has anyone been able to measure his interest in any of this stuff at this point?
I don't think he's said a lot, but my impression is that he's has a pretty pro-gun history. Mm-hmm. He's got the famous campaign commercial where he shot a gun into a television for reasons I'm not sure about. So I guess as speaker, he's going to listen to his caucus and see where they want to go.
Do Democrats have much leverage, though, there? I mean, he does need them for some things, right? Is that?
But I'm guessing that this is one of those things where, you know, the Republicans have the majority. This is a very hot button issue. This is my guess. He's going to feel compelled to listen to the Republicans in his caucus on it.
House Minority Leader Amelia Sykes called on the Republican leadership to start hearing another bunch of bills that have been introduced. Is that just spitting in the wind at this point, Joe Angles?
Well, no, I think the guns are the big thing, you know, right now. But there are a lot of things that the Democrats want heard, and you know, they'll be pushing for those. You know, if you look at different proposals out there that are getting some attention right now, this whole vaping thing is getting some attention. I think that. There's that fairness doctrine that's in the Senate. You know, Senator Nikki Antonio has been pushing for that. And in light of a lot of things that we've seen nationally, a lot of attention, I think that the Fairness Act basically would allow gay, lesbian, transgender, LGBTQ Ohioans to have protection under the state's laws against discrimination. And so they would like to have that.
But I thought that they specifically called on Republican leadership to hold hearings on a slate of bills they said will help reduce gun violence.
Yeah, right, so Democrats have a variety of pieces of legislation that they've already introduced in both the House and the Senate that would do things like red flag law and even like requiring that guns be stored safely and there be penalties if a kid got into a firearm and there was some sort of injury or death related to that. So these are pieces of legislation that have not had a lot of hearings. Mm-hmm. I think it's worth noting both Larry Householder and Senate President Larry Obhoff have A-plus ratings from the NRA. Larry Householder comes from Perry County, an area where, you know, one of the biggest fundraisers for the local county fair board is a gun raffle each year. And so it's an area where a lot of people have firearms for protection because the sheriff's office is quite far away. Compared to, you know, Columbus police or, you know, Cincinnati police will be there pretty quickly. So it's just a different culture and about surrounding guns and kind of the value of guns and the value of the Second Amendment than perhaps you might be used to seeing in the middle of a city. So I think he comes from that background, and I think that's going to inform his direction on this. So it's one reason why I think he will be less likely to support something like this than maybe it might get started in the Senate. Mm.
There does seem to be a on the gun issue. There does seem to be a rural urban divide too. I think if you look, you listen to these lawmakers, a lot of the rural lawmakers are much more. They look at guns in a different way. They look at it, you know, as protection and, you know, being able to fend for themselves.
Yeah. This is it's a fascinating thing to watch play out right now because you're right. The rural areas see guns a certain way. I've heard a number of Republicans say they're getting killed on this issue among suburban women.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And, you know, at the same time, it's like so many other things. It seems like the country's going in opposite directions at the speed of light on this. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of people that we're hearing from now, they're sick of the mass shootings. They're fed up with this idea that you can't do anything to regulate guns when regulation is contemplated in the Second Amendment itself. But at the same time, I'm hearing more and more people say, former Congressman Beto O'Rourke is talking about mandatory buybacks. I have seen several times recently people saying, you know, if you come for my AR-15, I'm going to shoot. You know, that's basically threatening violence with a firearm over what presumably would be, you know, a legitimate regulatory act by the government. I'm not saying it's necessarily a good idea, but, mm-hmm. you know, the Supreme Court's been clear.
Threatening violence.
Yeah. The Supreme Court's been clear. You can regulate weapons.
We're going to continue our conversation. We've been talking about the Governor Mike DeWine is going to unveil the legislation that represents in some form or another his proposed 17-point gun safety plan. It included, you know, a couple different proposals that are controversial still. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is our All Sides Weekly Reporter Roundtable. We'll be right back.
How do you turn what you love into a career? On season 2 of the Rivet podcast from WOSU, hear firsthand from students translating their interests into jobs without college. Listen to This American Graduate Project as we highlight the next generation of workers in the state's top industries of agriculture, insurance, and healthcare. Support for the Rivet podcast series comes from COSI. Subscribe now at wosu.org/rivet, on the WOSU mobile app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Still with us, Cincinnati Enquirer state government reporter Jesse Ballmert, Columbus Dispatch reporter Marty Schladen, and Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau reporter Joe Ingles. The Ohio Attorney General has said he will investigate new allegations that the group circulating petitions for a statewide referendum on the controversial nuclear bailout bill are being offered cash to quit the campaign and to sell signed petitions to the opposing side. What's going on with this, Marty Schladen?
Well, I think that the forces behind the bailout have some money in the bank that they're spending, which is an ironic thing. This is $1.5 billion bailout, and they're spending millions of dollars to preserve it. You know, and then this is a on behalf of a bankrupt company, I would add. But obviously, they've gone into the field with a super aggressive campaign to try to delegitimize the petition effort to get this on the ballot so that voters may have a chance to reject it.
They're actually going after the process of public referendums on issues. It could make people question the legitimacy of any referendum going forward. Joe Ingles?
Right. You know, it actually the whole campaign is a little bit xenophobic in a way. And, you know, it's got a tone about it that just is not really great. But the way that they're doing this is they're trying to – there's a fight over getting it on the ballot. And I think that, you know, it certainly sends the message that, hey, if this gets on the ballot, it's going to get repealed. That's the way the game's being played right now. You see the ads on TV, and one of the ads says, hey, if you've been approached to sign this nuclear bailout petition, give us a phone call at this number. And what they're doing, the side that wants to keep the money and keep the law in place, is actually offering, like you said, they're offering this petition, another petition that would basically, you know, that they could sign that would muddy the water. And then they're actually using a thing to try to get people to take their name or remove their name from the other petition. So there's like dueling petitions out there. And then there's this remove your name from the, you know, referendum, mm-hmm. the ones who want the referendum, remove your name from that petition. They've created a whole lot of confusion about the whole thing so that people who are signing petitions don't know which petition they're signing. And a lot of times, you know, they'll if you hear of where one side's going to be, the other side will show up to try to, you know, even make it more uncomfortable for people to sign.
Observers or their watchers,
blockers.
Right. Monitor.
They call them blockers.
Blockers, right? What is Attorney General Dave Yost going to look at?
Well, basically, I believe it's a felony. There's at least a crime associated with falsifying or like taking people's signatures after they've signed them for something else, like paying someone to obtain signatures. So this could potentially result in criminal charges. A lot of times it's hard to track down who these people are affiliated with. For example, there were three people arrested at Cincinnati State last week, and they were saying that they were there, the cops that they were there on behalf of an electric company. They were saying that they were trying to stop foreign investment in oil. You call all of the groups that are associated with this ballot initiative, and they're like, oh, no, that's not our person. That's not our guys. So there's a lot of paid petitioners being paid by other groups that are affiliated with these groups, which are loosely affiliated with First Energy Solutions. So it's kind of a bit of a mess out there. But to your point earlier about, does this make it harder for people to trust the process of getting something on the ballot? I know there is a group trying to get, you know, universal background checks into an initiated statute. Mm-hmm. There might be other folks in Cincinnati. There's people trying to put some sales tax on or something for the buses. And so it's got to be confusing when you're signing a petition when a bunch of people are saying, oh, don't sign that. Like, this, your information will be provided to a foreign government.
I want to come back to something Joe was saying, too. I think it very clearly is xenophobic when you mount a television campaign that says the Chinese are trying to take over our power grid. And I think we need to be, when we speak about this publicly, very clear. There is absolutely no evidence that this is the case.
Right.
All what we know is that one of the supporters of the petition drive has gotten money from a consortium of banks that include the Chinese state-owned bank, but so has First Energy.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And the French have money in it, and British.
Well, investment in any of these entities is completely normal now. It's not unusual.
We live in a global world. You know?
And the only difference is nuclear energy, by nature of all of the regulations surrounding it and concerns about, you know, the past history of nuclear energy, is not permitted to have any have a lot of foreign investment in it, as opposed to any other business in the history of businesses have a lot of investment from a lot of different places. I'm sure, you know, journalism companies are getting money all over the place, too.
We hope.
Kim in Oxford, you're on the air. Hi, Kim.
Yes, I was wondering if there was a way to sign the petition to get the measure on the ballot online in case you didn't run into a signature collector.
That's the hard thing. You know, we've had people, I don't know about you guys, but we've had people call our office and say, where do we sign this petition to put this thing on the ballot? Well, we contacted the person who we deal with, who is in charge of that side of the issue. And basically, it's been very difficult for the petition gatherers to get out there, because once they say publicly, hey, we're going to be at this place or that place, then the other side shows up and, you know, it's hard to get the signatures.
Yeah, there isn't really an online option, but I would say libraries and festivals and fairs are our usual place where people are collecting signatures for petitions.
Yeah, this is unusual. This is different than anything I ever remember.
Well, it's one of those things. I think the groups that are opposed to this referendum to block the money for the bailout feel like it's cheaper to get it killed before it makes the 2020 ballot than to fight a very costly war after that point. And so this is the kind of gamble they're making.
To take away or lessen the opportunity for a vote in the first place.
Mm-hmm. But if it does make it to the ballot, just imagine how this plays into the narrative of the side who wants the referendum. You know, they tried to keep you from getting to vote on this. You know, I can see the 30-second ad.
If they have the money, let's see. Joe in Bowling Green, you're on the air. Hi, Joe.
Hi. I just want to point out that the focus on the process here has kind of shifted the focus away from the referendum itself. And HB 6, this is what the referendum is about, to overturn HB 6. HB 6 is a horrible law. It's a terrible energy policy. And the people of Ohio should have a chance to weigh in on this with their vote and overturn it. And so these paid professionals that are keeping people from signing the petitions aren't just messing with a referendum. They're messing with democracy itself.
I would say I'm not going to weigh in on whether this is a horrible law or not, but there are plenty of things to debate about this piece of legislation in and of itself. Is it important that we keep jobs in northern Ohio that are, you know, good paying jobs for these communities that rely on these nuclear plants for things like school tax money, et cetera? Is it a problem that we are, you know, doing essentially a corporate bailout for one industry and we haven't done it for, you know, maybe coal plants that have closed in southern Ohio?
Although there are a couple coal plants that will be hoisted.
Yeah, the actual piece of legislation is for the two nuclear plants. There's a couple coal plants that will be guaranteed money. And then there's actually a handful of solar plants that would receive a little bit of money in this as well. But it also is essentially gutting efforts to encourage renewable energy and energy efficiency. Things like, you know, switching out your light bulbs or getting a more efficient appliance or something like that. So this is a piece of legislation that's worthy of debate, but we have been focused on the process a lot because the process has been kind of insane.
And there's an important aspect of the process too. Carlo Laparo, who is the spokesman for the bailout folks, says that if this gets onto the ballot, the game's over. That, you know, they were already threatening to close earlier. So we'll find out if that's true or not. That, you know, if they don't get these fuel rods, you know, within so many months, he says they're going to have to close those two reactors.
Yeah, but we heard when this was being debated that, you know, if we don't get this bill passed by such and such time, we're going under, and that didn't happen. So, I mean,
yeah, it's interesting. The fees aren't actually going to be collected until 2021 anyway because of kind of a last minute change in the legislature. So I understand it's important for businesses to have
a plan
and know where their money might be coming from for in the future. But they're not actually going to get a check until after 2020 regardless.
So they'll claw their way through somehow. Joe in Bowling Green, thanks a lot for your call. We appreciate it. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. So once again, I'm asking, okay, so it's going to be tough. So Attorney General Dave Yost is investigating these allegations about this alleged shady circulating of bogus petitions for a referendum. So what is he going to do? Is he just putting it out there to put it out there? Or is there, you know, it's complicated. I mean.
Yeah, like I said, it could result in criminal charges. I think that would be hard to nail down given how kind of transient these groups have been. But that's one thing. He also said that he set up like a hotline to call in if you have problems with people harassing you or harassing petitioners. And so we'll see if anything comes from that. I mean, I think it's valuable to try to put some guardrails on this whole system. But yeah.
Do you think he's also putting on notice the people who are running the pro HB6 campaign that, you know, because I not sure if Dave ever came out in support of the bailout itself, but certainly the Republican governor signed it.
Mm-hmm. Right away.
So I think perhaps he's also warning some of his erstwhile allies that, you know, you're going a little far on this. I don't know. I could be wrong about that.
Well, it definitely sends that message. So,
well, speaking of the governor, he has delayed another execution. Marty Schladen, you wrote about how he the latest delay. What's going on with that? And what do we expect going forward?
Well, I think there are two things with this latest one, Ann. First of all, they're not unable to get execution drugs. And we did a story a couple of weeks ago where we requested and received it's several years' worth of letters that these drug manufacturers have been sending to the state saying, don't use our stuff. This isn't an FDA-approved use, et cetera, et cetera. Under the Kasich administration, they just went ahead and did it anyway, even though there were some threats that we won't supply the state with drugs, period. But then with this latest execution delay, it came on the same day that disciplinary counsel announced actions against this inmate's lawyers, Cleveland Jackson. He had lawyers for five, six, 7 years, and they went years at a time without communicating with their client. In fact, he had an execution date set, and they never let him know about that even. So the governor cited that as well, that this disciplinary process has to play out before he, in good conscience, could send the guy to the death chamber.
You know, Governor DeWine has never been, bloodthirsty. Is that the word I'm looking for? He's when it comes to the death penalty, he supports it, or he says he does. He has said that in the past, but he's very careful with it. And you almost get the idea sometimes that he really doesn't support it as much. I think there's some issues that have been raised about the death penalty that, who is more likely to be executed, how it's applied, the process of it. And I think those kind of things have kind of raised some red flags in minds, and maybe even in Governor DeWine's mind.
Hmm. And even speaking with Speaker Larry Householder a little bit ago, he was saying that he had some concerns about being able to access the different drugs that are required and so forth. So I think you're seeing more and more Republicans say, this is a costly and hard to use process. But I don't know if that means they're going to get on board with abolishing the death penalty in Ohio. I think that's a leap for example, there's been a piece of legislation introduced in recent years, a bipartisan effort from Bill Seitz down in the Cincinnati area and usually a Democrat co-sponsor, that would ban the death penalty for those with severe mental illness. And even that's a piece of legislation that hasn't got into, a vote or pass. So if we're kind of hesitant to abolish it for even severe mental illness, are we on board for abolishing it across the board?
Surveys show that Ohioans, by and large, support the death penalty. But when you give them a choice between the death penalty and life in prison without a chance of parole, they prefer that.
And I think that public opinion is moving in that direction, too. Obviously, it's always a fluid thing, but mm-hmm. I don't know very many people who are really passionate about keeping the death penalty. But I'm hearing from more and more people who are calling for outright abolition. And you got to figure the critical mass is somewhere between those two poles.
The governor also has called on the legislature to ban the sale of vaping products. How fast do you expect the Ohio General Assembly to move on any of this, Jesse Balmert?
Well, I think it is a bigger priority for the governor than it is for the legislature right now.
I get that sense.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was looking for Joe to see if you agree. I think this is something that Mike DeWine is very concerned about. There are two things kind of happening side by side when it comes to electronic cigarettes. One is there are about 22 people in Ohio and hundreds of people across the nation who have had some sort of illness, lung illness related to electronic cigarettes. Most of these are because of using like illegal marijuana.
Bootleg type things,
some nicotine. Not a lot of evidence that like flavored vapes are like a driver on this. The age range in Ohio was something between like 15 years old and 59 years old of the people who've been ill. We haven't had any deaths so far, thank goodness. And so that's one thing that's happening. There's just this concern on both a national and state level about this illness that they haven't really pinned down 100% where it's coming from. But a lot of involving THC. And then the second concern is just Mike DeWine's concern about the increase in teenagers and children using electronic cigarettes, especially those ones that are flavored with things like bubble gum or mango.
They're not supposed to be able to get them anyways. They're underage, right. But be that as it may.
Yeah, they can get their hands on it, just right. Like they can get a beer if they want it. I mean, mm-hmm. You know, high school and middle school kids do mm-hmm. that. You know, that is the reason that some people say do an all-out ban on flavored vapes, because they know that high school kids or middle school kids can get their hands on flavored vapes if their older brother or sister, if their older parent or whatever gets them. So, but, you know, I don't see that, you know, there's... The legislature is not jumping on this, by and large. And, you know, while you're talking about vape store owners, you know, they say, oh, well, we're going to have to shut down if you take away these flavor vapes, because they say that's where most of their, you know, people, they want to buy those products. And a lot of people, there was a rally last week at the Ohio State House, and it was people who vape flavored products. And they were saying that, you know, they've used successfully these flavored vapor products to be able to kick smoking. And a lot of them had smoked for decades and have been able to, now, you know, is one trade-off better than the other? We can go down that road.
That's the thing. There's been very little study done in any of these things. The fact is we just don't
know.
It's new.
No. And does it have to taste like strawberry in order to be, you know, a substitute for smoking cigarettes if you're trying to quit the, you know, the Marlboro Reds?
Well, they say, a lot of them say they like that flavor because it's something, you know, that pacifies them.
Yeah. I mean, this is an imperfect analogy, but a lot of people like, you know, caramel macchiato flavored whipped with the extra sprinkles more than just straight black coffee. So I think
crazy, all of them.
And those are the people that tie up the line at Starbucks.
Yes
crazy. They do.
Yeah, but I get the sense that like choice is something that consumers want, and if you're a responsible adult consumer over the age, you don't see why this product should be taken away from you because teenagers might use it in an inappropriate manner. But I think Governor DeWine's point is this is being marketed to create a demand for this among young children and set them up for the same problems that, you know, smokers have had health-wise for quite some time.
So there's echoes of Joe Camel. I don't know if you remember him.
I do. Mm-hmm.
But that was the whole idea then, was that it was Camel cigarettes were advertising to youthful
audience. It
was a
cartoonish figure.
Yeah. And, you know, it sounds pretty cynical, but the accusation was that they were creating their next generation of customers.
We will continue our weekly reporter roundtable. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Still with us, Cincinnati Inquirer, state government reporter Jesse Ballmert, Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau reporter Joe Engels, and Columbus Dispatch reporter Marty Schladen. Marty, you wrote about how what is being called a critical infrastructure bill in Ohio is actually, according to its critics, meant to silence protesters. Tell us about this.
Well, it's a piece of legislation that's similar to forms of it that were passed in nine other states. There was model legislation created by the American Legislative Exchange Council, which is heavily financed by people like the Koch brothers and Marathon Petroleum. And it seems that's what's happened is after the really high profile protests in North Dakota by the Standing Rock Sioux tribe in 2016, these energy companies have decided they need to get a handle on this. Now, this isn't packaged as strictly a pipeline bill, but what it would have the effect of doing is enhancing penalties for protesting within the right of way of the pipeline. So one of the vague things about the bill is it says that if you tamper with this infrastructure, that's punishable by a third degree felony and a $10,000 fine. And the kicker is if you belong to a group like Greenpeace or whatever, or they determine that you might be, Greenpeace then could be fined $100,000. And it's not contingent upon how much the person on the scene gets fined. The law spells out that it would be 10 times the maximum penalty for this felony. The energy company supporters of the bill say this is to keep people safe. They're not trying to stop people from protesting. But critics say this is intended to give everybody pause before you ever go show up.
Do the states where it's already been enacted tell are part of this story? I mean, are those clues to the intent?
I think so. Yeah, and the states who have enacted them are energy states with lots of pipelines, and it would appear that because there are already criminal penalties for doing things like stopping progress of a legit trespassing's a crime is what I'm trying to say in
right.
my muddled way already, but increasing these penalties and having this specter of $100,000 fine lurking out there for some nonprofit group that.
Who's sponsoring this legislation?
It's from Mingo Junction.
That's okay. Bill Sykes is a member of ALEC, right?
Yes. Yeah, a lot of the Republicans.
Is he in the House or the Senate now?
He is in the House now.
Okay, I'm sorry.
It's sometimes hard to keep track, but yes.
Yeah. Okay.
There are different opinions about ALEC. On the left, it's seen as basically this dark way of enacting legislation on behalf of corporate interests. But to supporters, for example, what's so illegitimate about a natural gas pipeline? There are serious environmentalists who think that it's a bridge fuel while we develop other technologies. It's lower in carbon emissions than burning coal, for example. We all use the energy that natural gas creates. So, there's a feeling that these things should be able to be built. But that's a whole other developing thing now. Traditionally, the way that pipeline companies in most states acquire land is they go onto your land and say, I know this is going across the middle of your back 40, but if you don't make a deal with us, we're going to go into court and have eminent domain declared. But there was a story just this past week that a federal court out east sided with state governments who stopped pipelines from crossing state land. So there's a feeling, maybe it's a hope from people on the other side that it may not be so easy to get eminent domain declared. And in some of the pipelines in Ohio, they're carrying natural gas to Canada. And, just like in Texas, they're carrying it to Mexico. And one lawyer last week told me that there's one pipeline in Ohio that's carrying natural gas byproducts to Canada to make plastic. So is that a public good worthy of?
Is that, yeah, critical infrastructure.
Right.
Joe Ingles, you wrote about the House's decision not to include protections for LGBTQ employees. Mm-hmm. They haven't dropped anything. They just haven't embraced it? Or did they drop something?
No, they dropped it. Okay. They totally removed it. It was in the House policies before. And then the House has got a new HR director after all the sexual harassment claims and everything that was going down last year, you'll remember.
Right.
And so they've got this new HR director, and they came out with a new policy book. And Minority Leader Amelia Sykes says when they came out with that policy book, she immediately noticed that that provision had been removed. And so she went to that basically it all went up the chain of command. Mm-hmm. And Speaker Householder has said that the reason it was removed is it is not in state law, that we do not have any provision in state law that protects LGBTQ employees from being fired or being, you know, housing
discrimination. But they have the prerogative to do it on their own as a arm of the
They do.
Government.
And here's the thing. And every other state government agency, every other state, you know, like all the elected leaders, even the Senate, they all have that line in there to protect their LGBTQ employees. And, you know, the House is the outlier. And he said, he told reporters right after, you know, when we were asking about it, he said, you know, he goes, I didn't realize that we were the only outlier. But he still thinks that, you know, it needs to be in state law and follow state law.
He did point to a section of the policy that he said does protect people. Did he not? Or is it?
I didn't hear that from him directly, but there, you know, some have said that there is a part of the state, you know, policy now that protects. But we've, you know, the thing is, we do not have that written. It's not codified in state law that if you're, you know, LGBTQ, that you have those protections. There have been for a decade. Or more. There have been proposals that would do that, but the lawmakers have just never taken them up.
Yeah. I mean, I think everyone might recall one of Governor Mike DeWine's first actions as mm-hmm. governor was to extend John Kasich's kind of last minute addition. One of his last moves was kind of there was some question whether Mike DeWine would leave that in or would not for protections for both gender identity and sexual orientation. But Mike DeWine said that was fine for the executive employees, the people who kind of worked underneath him, but the House and Senate can come up with their own policies. But I do think it's interesting, as Joe obviously said, the Senate has had in their policies protections for sexual orientation since 2015. So it's not necessarily a new policy in the Ohio General Assembly.
Has anybody besides Amelia Sykes complained?
Oh, yeah. I think we're hearing that undercurrent of that. But, you know, here's the big thing, Anne, that, you know, Amelia Sykes pointed to and others have said. These businesses, there's like a consortium of like 600 businesses who have come out and said, you know, it is important to attract LGBTQ employees to Ohio. And the argument they make is if you don't have protections for those employees, a lot of big companies, big businesses that are expanding, that bring a lot of good jobs, they won't come to Ohio without those protections. Mm-hmm. And so that's the point that they make. And even the Ohio Chamber has come out and said, you know, there is a business interest in all of this.
Yeah. And it sends a message if you aren't going to include it in your own policy, how interested are you in making this into state law?
Hmm. Okay. Jesse Ballmer, you wrote last week that Ohio is still, there aren't any Ohio lawmakers pushing for legislation that would allow collegiate student athletes to profit from their name, image, or likeness, as they will be starting in 4 years in the state of California. It looks like the state of New York is quick to follow. And I think there's probably like 13 to 18 other states out there that are interested in this. What about Ohio? What do you know?
Yeah, so Ohio is taking a kind of wait-and-see approach to the name, image, and likeness. we're a fan of being the back 25
usually,
sometimes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think what they both Governor DeWine and Speaker Larry Householder expressed some concerns with NCAA law, like rules not lining up with the California law, and will you be able to participate in bowl games if you are being paid by the local car dealership or something for an ad. I think that's something that California and the NCAA are going to get figured out before 2023 when that legislation takes effect. But I think they would like to see how it plays out in states like California and others that are considering it. It's interesting. I think maybe if Ohio State University with their football players and basketball players got really interested in this legislation, you might see it come up. But it isn't something Ohio State is pushing for right now.
No.
Athletic Director Gene Smith, in fact, said we're not going to play teams from California after this takes effect because it won't be fair. So he's doing what he can to, I think, tamp it down.
And the thing that a lot of people are looking at, too, is, yes, you've got these big superstars that will get, you know, endorsement deals, but not everyone on that team even is a superstar. And some teams are worth more monetarily than others. So, and then you take into account that it's not just,
But that's the way it happens in the pro world, too.
Right, exactly how it happens. But when you're at the collegiate level, it's, you're taking the student out of the student athlete. You're making the priority on the athletic part of it. And you've got the D2 and the D3 schools that would be affected by this as well, the poaching aspect, all the different aspects of this. There's a lot of moving parts. Mm-hmm.
But another side of that, though, is these universities, particularly the one whose campus we're sitting on right now, mm-hmm. they make a lot of money off of these kids. And you know, even the non-big-timers, I heard a thing, I guess it was NPR National last week, about, let's say you're a field hockey player, women's field hockey player. You know that it ends with your collegiate career. So this is your only chance to get anything, even if it's a couple of $100.
Yeah, but, here's the thing. I mean, too, the other thing is that, if we look at where the money is in athletics right now, the money has kind of corrupted in some ways. And we don't have student athletes being compensated at this point. We just have, the money running the programs.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of things that have been corrupted by that money, a lot of decisions that are made because of massive amounts of money going into programs. So, you start giving it out to the athletes as well and compensating them. What effect does it have? It's kind of a new territory mm-hmm. out there because we don't know how that's going to work. But a lot of people are saying, hey, let's go to that table very cautiously because we don't want to, go busting open the door and then create a bunch of unintended consequences.
This is an issue that's been, people have been debating it for 25, 30 years
right.
now.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like it's a new issue. The NCAA has now started a special committee. I think Gene Smith is serving on the committee. I know Michael Drake, president of Ohio State, is involved. Of course, Ohio State's involved. It's one of the biggest moneymakers in the country. It's an emotional issue, but it's not as if they haven't been cautious already.
Yeah, but I think there's a lot of,
topic.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. But, the way California's law is, it just threw the door open.
Right. And as it does with many things,
right,
like polluting
right. exactly.
cars and that kind of a thing.
Right. And I think that there are a lot of, people who are involved with college athletics who are saying, hey, can we just slow this down and really, if we're going to go that direction, then let's think about how to go that direction without introducing a lot of problems into the. And we don't know how California is going to be affected, actually, mm-hmm. because theirs doesn't start until 2023.
Yeah, they're like, I mean, there's states right behind them.
Right.
They are queuing up. I mean,
yeah,
Ohio
I
might not be among
Kentucky.
Them, but yeah, Kentucky, New York. It's not going to be alone for long, mm-hmm. from what I understand. Poll shows Biden, Sanders, Warren all leading Trump in Ohio. What do you make of that, Jesse Ballmer? Sorry, I almost got all the way through.
It's
the
a
show.
Monday.
We only have about a minute left.
Yeah, I mean, I think the three names are not surprising because they're the names that people have heard of. So what it tells you is very early in the race, people have heard of those three Democratic mm-hmm. candidates. To me, it was interesting because they just have such like vastly different policies on how they would approach things like Medicare or, healthcare in general. So that's interesting. But
so
I mean,
more about just change versus particular policies?
I think so. But I do think it shows that Ohio might still be in play, which is something Democrats would very much like their donors to keep believing.
Hmm. That's all the time we have. Thank you so much, Jesse Ballmert, for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
And Joe Ingles, Jesse Ballmert's with State Government Reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer. Joe Ingles of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, thanks for joining us.
Great to be here.
And Marty Schladen, reporter for the Columbus Dispatch, thanks to you as well.
Thank you, Ann.
Thanks to everybody else for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.